capture, like when Marion ran in 76, and this was the advisory council, advisory home neighborhood council. They were the precursor to the ANC. And so probably my mom got all these buttons because she worked a little bit with Barry, and then Dave Clark, you know who he is, and then Fauntleroy. Oh, Hilda Mason, not as well known, important, but so that was kind of like the political stuff happening in the neighborhood. Oh, and then my mom ran for ANC, I made her that, but she did not win. Her friend won, and she, but she got on the Democratic State Committee. Anyways, I just thought.
No, that's thanks for bringing this in. It's really cool. I hadn't seen the original.
Stuff. I have more stuff, but I'll show you later, or I'll show you now, and then you can refer to them if you want to.
Okay.
This is just so you know. This is so. My street was so politically active that her dad lived on the street. Marcus Raskin. He ran the Institute for Policy Studies, and that's her little brother Jamie Raskin, who is now Maryland State Senator.
Oh wow.
And that's me. And this was a march called Ring Around the Capitol. And it was supposed to be a lot of kids. There weren't that many kids, but and this is Joan Baez. And so this is LaDonna Harris. And that's Candace Bergen. I mean, we were up at the front because Erica's dad knew Joan Baez, you know that. And she needed to have some kids.
That's really cool.
Yeah. That's enough.
That's great. Thank you for...
Okay.
This was,
1972. Yeah.
And what was the ring around... What was it in regards to...
The... Nixon was bombing... either North Vietnam... I'd have to check. North Vietnam or Cambodia. I think he was bombing Cambodia. And... we were just making a point that kids were getting killed.
Anyways, so. That's great, though. And Candace Bergen and LaDonna. Oh, wow.
It's kind of wild.
It's quite a...
Somebody from Newsweek snapped the picture, and then it got in that little section. My friend Erica, Joan Baez, and I cut Candace Bergen out, and Jamie Raskin, the young Jamie Raskin. So, but anyway.
That's a special shot.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like it. It hangs in our kitchen.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a perfect segue. So, and your family arrived in D.C. Was it late 68 or early 69 that you actually arrived in D.C.?
No, it was 68 because we moved to make sure. Okay, it was August of 68. So it was after the riots. And I know that it was because it was my birthday the day we moved, and I will never forget it.
And what day is that?
September 2nd, 1968. So we missed the riots, and I know my mother moved us there because, like, September 3rd was the first day of school, and so she had to get us in there. So that's why it was that day.
And where were you coming from?
Coming from suburban Alexandria, from a community called Virginia Hills, which they were like little brick houses, and that's where my dad lived. We stopped living with my dad and came to live with my mom, and it's actually still the same. I drove up it the other day. It's everything around it has ballooned up, but that little community, it's pretty much the same. You know, it's like probably a quarter acre of a yard and a little brick house with two bedrooms. Yeah. So, anyways, that's where we moved from.
And do you have any sense? I mean, either at the time or now, in retrospect, why your mother chose to move to Adams Morgan, and even more specifically, mm-hmm. Lanier Place.
I know, actually, yeah. exactly why. Because she hadn't had us kids for like 3 years. My parents had been separated, and she was going to have to kind of like have us and take care of us and work on her own. So she wanted to be close to someone she knew, and she had met this woman, Barbara Nelson. She had met this woman playing bridge out in Virginia when she was still married. And when Barbara heard that this was happening, Barbara said, come move onto my street. She probably found us the house. And they lived four houses up. And they were like our guardian angels for years.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, they're still we're still very close with them. Yeah.
And I mean, of all the neighborhoods and even of all the blocks, that was quite a place to be moving to, and no less in 1968. And so was there a connection between the significance of the neighborhood or even that block or that street and any of your own mother's political leanings? Or did it just happen to be the case that this is where her friend lived and her friend was like, come live nearby us?
You know, I'm pretty sure that for Barbara Nelson and then for my mom, Carol Davis, it was just a good street. You know, like it had nice homes, nice families. It was very mixed back then. And also it was one way. I don't know if my mother thought about this, but it was one way so that the hook and ladder could pull out of the fire station. There's a fire station on it. But that meant that you could play touch football, and there was all this space. So I think Barbara knew it was a good street. She may even have intuited that it was going to shift because she bought another house on the street, too. So they had always bought houses and lived in them for a while and sold them, but Lanier, they stayed. So I think with my mother, it was just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I've got these three kids, and now I have to work and get them in a school. Let me get on the same street as Barbara, take the kids to the same school that I would go to church. Me, personally, I went to church with her daughter. You know, it was just like built-in help. Yeah. So I think that was it. But pretty quickly, it became clear what the street was. But, you know.
And had your mom lived in D.C. ever before in her life, or was she originally?
Yes, oh, okay. Yes. My mom, when my parents separated, my dad stayed in Virginia, and my mom moved into the city. And she was dating an African-American guy, which certain people in her life, including my father, it upset them. So they lived in Southwest then. But then when she came up to Lanier Place, he came. It didn't last, but after about 4 or 5 years he left. But so she did what she knew pretty well is the black community. My mom. Because of her boyfriend, Pete.
And so that was, in other words, her experience with D.C. was both relatively recent, I mean several years before you having moved to Lanier Place, and also through her relationship with Pete.
She really moved in that, she went to a lot of black clubs, she went to, after hours clubs, and I'm jumping ahead a little, but because Pete was there on, not every Sunday, but my mom would fry chicken, and then they would play Bidwist. Bidwist at the house. And like forever, the game would last for hours, and you know, we would meet the guys, they'd come in, and the girlfriends, and I can still hear that game, you know. I'm going uptown, you know, and stuff like that. So, and I was like, I didn't understand it, but But, you know, it was nice. They were, you know, great people. And so it was fun to have, like, a family dinner, even though it was included a card game. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it was kind of quite, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that it must have been a pretty radical shift in your own life and your siblings from very suburban Virginia to Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it was. It was. We... You know, obviously it's the classic thing. We could play outside until it got dark. There was a creek and we were running all around and at my dad's and it was great. My brothers wanted to move with my mama. I did not. I liked my life the way it was. And so I had a slower adjustment, but bottom line, because my mom was very deaf at getting us inserted with a group of kids, there was one Nelson for every Davis. Huh. And then there was even a little Nelson for my half-sister, Karma, who stayed with my dad. But, you know, the minute we got in with them, they're like, let's go do this. Let's play football. You know, we walked across the bridge to go to school together. And pretty quickly, there was a very nice routine. So I don't remember anybody being really, not at first.
And which school did you first go to when you arrived in D.C.?
I went to Oyster, which was, it was not bilingual then. It was just a kind of regular school, but had a great reputation. It had like a cut above. My mom, Barbara showed her how to do something so that I think we were like a half block outside of the area, but Barbara showed her how to get in the area and we got to go. And I had the most phenomenal teacher of my whole life in sixth grade there. Mrs. Mary Alice Jackson. Her son is Reuben Jackson, who's a poet. Yeah, and he used to work at the Smithsonian, so... So it was a great, it was a mixture of kids, but there was a sprinkling of embassy kids, which made it kind of have this nice cachet. And then there were just us kids from across the bridge. Yeah.
Huh. And where were the places that you played or hung out most in the neighborhood at that point? So I guess in the first couple of years after you moved.
Yeah. Well, we did. We played touch football almost every day. Spring, summer, and fall, not winter. But, I mean, you would come home from school and there'd be like a crew. There was this guy, Dean McDonald. He was the permanent quarterback. I sometimes got in there. And my brother was very fast, my brother Jim. My brother Sam was kind of little, so he was sort of a bother. But then there were all these other kids, Warren Butts, who if he was in a bad mood, he would steal the football from you. but if he always came back, Durkee Roy. Myself was Beth Nelson, myself and my friend Erica would play too. And there were lots of other kids, but that's the crew I remember. So we would just play. And my mother would call us in around 6. We'd go in, invariably take one person to eat with us, usually Dean. And Dean lived like 3 doors down. But it was just really nice. And then if the weather was nice, we'd go right back out and play some more.
So it was mainly on the street itself.
Literally on the street. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't remember going to a park ever. I mean, we played on the street. What's now called Walter Pierce Park was very rough. It was called Ghetto Stadium then. That had been named that by the kids on Ontario Place. Kalorama Park we could go to, but it seemed far to me, so we never went.
And were there distinctions within? Well, first of all, when did you know that your neighborhood was Adams Morgan when you moved into it? Was that something that was like a part of your sense of your place in D.C. or your family's place? No.
No, using the name, I think that came later. Mm. I think they called it Lanier Heights. Mm. But no, they didn't call it anything. Mm. They did, you know, Lanier, you know, you're on Lanier Place. But I do not remember, but I do remember that I had a point of view about the people in Kalorama. Huh. And not so much Mount Pleasant. Mm. But, you know, I...
What was that point
well,
of view?
Well, they seemed wealthy to me, wealthier. Uh-huh. And... not as nice, mm. not as at ease with the kind of like kids playing and running around, mm. making noise, and I didn't know anybody who lived mm. there. Mm. So
there was a kind of, there was neighborhoods within neighborhoods.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But things like Washington Heights, Lanier Heights, Calrama, was that, were those
I think
terms
that... I do not remember that at all when I was younger. What I remember that like, but when I'm about like 30.
Oh, really? Okay.
But it's also possible that I became aware of it because mm-hmm. then I was getting involved with the neighborhood through community things. Mm-hmm. So, but definitely. Oh, there's one more button. Definitely, AMO. Was the name of the organization.
Yeah, and that had been around.
Yeah,
before.
That was around. So yeah. I think I just didn't use it because I have the button in here that says AMO, but anyway, I can't find it. So I think it was there, but maybe it's just that as kids, we knew it more intuitively. Mm-hmm. You could play in Walter Pierce Park. Well, you didn't call it that. It was Community mm-hmm. Park West. But there was a lot of cut glass, and you might, you know, and it was a cemetery, and there were still bones around, and so they said. And then, and there were beat up cars. But you know, then there was Kalorama, and then Mount Pleasant, which I would go to, but it was more like go over there and get a pupusa or something. Yeah, yeah.
And you were doing that as a kid?
Yeah, we could. Well, the first time I remember going to get food... No, we did a lot. There was an amazing Italian deli on Columbia Road. They left.
Do you ever remember what they were called?
I would recognize it. So maybe if you got old...
photos or...
Yeah. It was right next to Saxatone. Tape. Okay. Records and tapes. And then... So I was allowed to go pretty much anywhere, and but I would go up there, and then like in 1970 or so, the Churreria Madrid came, and they started making these churros, which are bread that you fry, and it's really delicious. And I was always going up there to get churros.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then the parents would send you, go get a dozen churros. It was like we were in love with it.
And where was that?
That's still there.
Okay.
That is next to City Bikes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's there. It's kind of, you know, unobtrusive, but I don't know how they're doing, but they were from Spain.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Not from Latin America. But, as long as I'm talking about food, I'll tell you about my favorite restaurant. It was called the Omega Restaurant. Mm. Do you know it?
I don't.
Okay, it was just a little tiny restaurant, and it was over getting towards Kalorama, but it was run by Cubans, and I just remember my mom taking us there to eat the food, rice, beans, and then enchiladas, and I remember her taking like all of us kids and one other kid, and the bill was $14. But that restaurant burned down, and people say it had something to do with fight between anti-Castro and pro-Castro people, but I don't know about that.
And what year was, do you happen to, or what?
I don't remember it burning down, so it could have happened when I was at college.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. And were there other, either restaurants, other kinds of institutions of any sort in the neighborhood that you kind of looked forward to going to, or you didn't look forward to going to, but that were important parts of your neighborhood life early on?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was pretty young, we would use the back door to Avion Frères, which is a big, important bakery and candy-making place. we would just use it as a cut through, and they never cared. And there was all this guy, Giuseppe, like hand cranking, and he would go, he would like raise his eyebrows, and we'd scatter, and but I have a, you know, in the end, when I was older, I worked there, and then even when I was older, people bought it, but other places, you know, I think homes, you know, there, but to go into Barbara Nelson's home, and she, my mom and Barbara and other people, they did this thing back then, which is not happening now, which was that they lived with their face outside to the street, you know, so literally the doors were open. I mean, you know, but you could walk into Barbara's and they would be having a big dinner with 20 people and she'd have you come sit down. And she was a great cook. My mom was more like, I'll take one or two of you in and feed you. But so it was that living in the street, as it were. I mean, metaphorically, but really sitting on the porch a lot and having that orientation being out. And then it's everything's open, and then you pull people in. I mean, the kid I mentioned about who played football, he basically, wherever we went, he went. And his mom worked at a cafeteria. There was no dad. And Dino was just part, you know, became part of our family. I remember, here's a public thing. We would go across the bridge. There was an ice skating rink at the Sheridan. You had to join, and my mom joined. But when she joined, she usually had like five other kids, and including Dean, who was black. And he'd be like, I'm not so sure that he's your kid. And she was like, do you need my husband to come up here? And they didn't. They accepted him. But it was that kind of thing. You'd just grab a kid. So... And so that was it. Let me think about more public spaces. In a little bit, but I don't know if you want to move forward, but just like a year, 70, like when the communes started appearing, we went into the communes all the time too. So it was just pretty much how we went into the Nelson's house. I mean, sometimes they would kick us out, but not usually.
And right, how many communes were there on your block?
Well,
was there more than one?
Oh,
on your block?
Oh, yeah. There was a radical communist commune. There was a big red fist poster on the front door. And the people next door, they were German. Those people I didn't talk to too much. There was a house that was planning the May Day action, which was an attempt to shut the whole city down. And so that was a commune. That was a May Day commune. And then next door, there were Black Panthers, I think, or Black Radicals, I'm not sure. But and then underneath them, there were Native Americans who took over the BIA. That happened in... you'll have to look some of these things up. But so... And then across the street, Rennie Davis, who was a big leader, he had a house in, I don't know if it was a commune. My friend's dad sort of had like a commune thing going on. So, you know, that's, what is that, six or seven?
On it, one block.
Yeah. Oh, well, really, like, I mean, just that, clustered around, you know. And
I mean, that has to say something about that block. I mean
yes,
that.
I don't really know what it goes back to. They were inexpensive places to rent, but I don't know, usually in that kind of setting somebody comes first or second, you know, and then it goes, but I never knew how that happened. And I think I've asked a few people that question, and they're just like, it was a nice street, it was cheap. That's all we needed, you know. But then, of course, once you have a couple like the May Day commune, then I think it started building.
And was there, I mean, I'm imagining maybe that you were too young to have that at least directly influenced your own political awakening or consciousness, or maybe not, I don't know. What was it, something that you, were you just a kid running around and seeing these things, and it was late, years later that you kind of, or did that kind of having those spaces on your block and running in and out and being around that, do you have a sense of it having influenced or impacted you in some way?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. It, I mean, when you ask, was it this or that? I mean, I still was a kid, and some of it even scared me. And but I also was influenced, and it, obviously, I didn't understand everything in its depth. But going into Mark Raskin's house, he wouldn't just say, "Oh." He'd stop you, he'd take your hand and kind of swing it, and he'd go, "What do you think about Lieutenant Calley?" I don't know. "Well, here's what I think you should consider." You know, Erica and I went with him to the Eddie Leonard subway shop. It was a great subway shop. The night they listed Nixon, they got that Nixon's enemies list, and Mark was on it. Yeah, and so he took us like at midnight to go get it, and then he read it and kind of pontificated about like this is not America. They shouldn't be like having lists about people like that. So some of those things, and then there's a group I haven't really mentioned that Pedro Lujan was one of the first Latino leaders in the community, not the only, but and he. He was really, you know, always fighting for the Latinos to get opportunities, but also he had Cesar Chavez come to his house once and for a fundraiser. I think he was trying to get money for the farm workers. And so Pepe, well, so Erica's father and Erica and Liz's father was my best friend, and Pepe, that had a huge influence on me. So there were these women, my girls, my age. Liz was a little older, but they were deeper into it. Erica was always surrounded by it, so I really definitely began to kind of care a lot about justice and to see that it was important to live a life of justice. But I also saw that you didn't have to be like Mark Raskin or Pepe Lujan. My mom was a real fighter for justice. She just did it in this very low-key way. So I saw that too, you know.
How did you start seeing that peer its head? You know,
oh,
your mom's own...
Right. Well, so, like, I remember an event that happened and that I kind of stayed up on the porch that was Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins... had just gotten out of jail, so the people in the Mayday commune, they sort of closed the street and they had a banner. And they, I just can still remember, like, "Victory to Bobby, victory to Erica, free ourselves and we'll free America." But to me, it was like everybody was smoking pot, they were drinking beer. I saw two men kiss each other. And it's kind of scared me, so I stayed up. Like, it just was... too intense. I thought it was interesting. My mom came out and was up on the porch, but she walked down in the block party, got a beer, and she was fine. Like, she was happy. But I actually stayed up there with Pete, because I don't know what Pete thought about it, but I was just, like, staying up there. But, so, I don't know where I was going to go with that. But, rear its head. I saw my mom be brave in different ways, which was like that. She was just having a relaxation after work, but she started to get a little bit involved in politics. But for instance, my brother had a really great friend named Marlon, and my brother was a Boy Scout, and my brother brought Marlon, who was black, to the Boy Scouts, and they wouldn't let him in, and. I think he came home and told Mom, and he didn't really understand it. She was like, "Don't worry, I'll go with you next Friday." So she went, and she apparently, I don't know if it was that Friday, they were going to have some beautiful candlelit ceremony about the values of being a Boy Scout. She said, "Look, motherfucker." She did. She said, "I will blow all the candles out, and I will yell and scream about you racists if you don't let this young man in." Marlon didn't see that. I don't even think Jimbo did, my brother. But they let him in. But he only went a couple times. I think he could tell he wasn't, welcome. Yeah. So, like, that for me, I knew what happened. I didn't witness it. Because probably my mom came home and told me the story. But she was like, "Sometimes you have to be tough. And you definitely have to stand up for other people." And so that's when I saw her kind of search for justice as it got, you know. And then slowly she got involved in local politics. But, yeah.
And do you have any sense of where her sense of justice came from? I mean, her commitment to...
Not really. I mean... I don't see a role model. She used to tell me that Pete taught her a lot, that the African-American boyfriend. And maybe it was that, because they would go into settings and either, like, people would be upset with her for being white or upset with him for being black. And she said, "Pete taught me how to be tough, and I had to be tough to live in the city and take care of you guys." So... I have to ask her that, but it could have been that, her experience, you know, they'd get it both ways, and then, but mostly from whites, and my grandfather was so against them being together, he sent a private eye to follow them, and to offer him money, and he didn't take it,
So that probably kind of also fueled your mom's own sense of injustice.
Yeah. And how and when
did she start to get involved more deeply in local politics?
You know,
or did it just seem to naturally grow out of
She, like her friend Barbara Nelson, never went to a community meeting, ever. So that was not like that she was taken into it. I think it was the home rule, you know, appealed to her when she first moved to Washington. She couldn't vote. And so that was, that really appalled her. And, So she met a group of people in Adams Morgan. Like, she might have gone to one meeting. I don't know what the first one was, but she met Frank Smith, who was a former city council member, and he was very he did the statue, the African American military statue at down by Shaw. And she met Frank, she met a woman named Marie Nahikian, who was a big housing advocate. I think for her it was also a little social. I just remember she would, like, when people wanted to have a big party, they'd have it at her house.
Oh, really?
Same thing, open door. But somebody got married in our house, and but they were always doing fundraisers, and... And she loves politics, so she doesn't really do it anymore. But I'll have to ask her, though, and I could email you that. What was the first thing?
And I guess by the mid-70s, you were in high school. I mean, around the time when, not always, but sometimes people's political consciousness is growing, or awareness is growing. And I'm wondering what being from that block and that neighborhood, yeah. how and if that shaped any, you know, your growing political consciousness or awareness, or was it more just the fact of it wasn't a self-awareness about your own political consciousness, but just a reflection of where you were living and right. the kinds of places you were existing in?
Well, no, I think it was a self-awareness. I remember that we used to have bookmobiles in D.C., that a big van would come and there were books, and I would go there, and I remember always asking for, like, could you bring the little red book for me? I don't know what I was doing. I had him bring Man, Child, and the Promised Land and the autobiography of Malcolm X. I mean, and I read the books. I was really interested because, I mean, like, I had sat out on the porch with some of the Black Panthers and they had talked at length about some of their ideas. And maybe they said, get that book, or I just thought it would be good to get it. And so I became pretty progressive, and it was pretty authentic, you know. Again, being influenced like by the Lujan family and the Raskin family, I was always up to date with whatever happened. You know, if anything significant happened politically, I'd know about it from Erica, and this is before the internet. So her father was spied upon by the FBI, and so I really embraced it. It was who I was. I mean, I read a lot of books, and I was always like, I kind of liked being up in my room reading. And then I went to public school until ninth grade, and when I got to, I got a scholarship to go to Sidwell Friends. And I had been in public school, and I remember wearing that political point of view, almost like armor. You know, they were nice kids, but I was very arch about it all, you know. And I found out that Ronald Haft was in the class. He's the son of a developer, and I would fight with him all the time about development and gentrification. Poor guy! You know? And he was always nice to me. I was like, you know, you really need to talk to your father. Because they own property on Columbia Road, and I was really upset about it. And that was just from being around. Everyone was politicized. My brothers were. I have to say that my brothers, especially my older brother and his friends, were going to this phase where all they did was smoke pot. And, like, they were kind of lost to us. I wasn't, Erica wasn't, and so there was a, you know, we stopped playing football in the street, you know, there's some more political stuff, but then they started being like, if you were sitting around with them, they'd be like, I want to hear some Frank Zappa. They lost their edge, let's say. But I got elected, and I'd have to check the state, but I became a student representative to AMMO when I was probably like around 12.
12?
But I didn't, you know.
What were the issues that you remember AMMO kind of being on the forefront of their agenda at that time? Or?
Well, they were very concerned about the right to make our own decisions in the city. Very concerned about housing. Back then, that was like the first wave of gentrification. You know, people were being kicked out of their buildings, and having rent strikes, and some won, some lost. But we were involved in that, you know. Well, or just maybe knew about it, and then so those two things, and really, they were about community control. Like community control of the school. There were a lot of things on 18th Street. One was called the Music Carryout, and it was a little storefront, and Erica's dad started it. You could just go in and take an instrument and take it out, and you were supposed to bring it back. So, you know, there. And it was very hopeful. Then trying to think what else was, you know, there. But so that's what I remember AMMO being about. And then, you know, they had their, they used the Adams Morgan organization to duplicate how there might be a series across the city, a series of representative bodies. So AMMO was the model, and they were very proud, and those meetings, they were good.
Do you remember where you went to meetings?
Yeah, it was on 18th Street. I think it was, they had an AMMO office. And then if it was really big, it might be in the Marie Reed School. But I do remember now my mother saying that when she first went to some of the meetings, there were these older black women. And at first they were a little standoffish. But the more they were at meetings together, they brought like mom over to sit with them, and that they would work together to like achieve things. And Ruth Long, Eudora Webster, Joe Butler, maybe a name you've heard. And they were amazing. And I would occasionally go to the meetings with my mom. They would just be nice to me, and I would just sit and listen. I don't know why I was doing that. I hate listening to meetings, but it was exciting. These were really smart, creative people, and you knew something was going on. So I wanted to be around that. I thought that was pretty interesting.
And what was the experience like of going to Sidwell Friends, and maybe that the difference between, you know, your previous schooling experiences and there?
Yeah, it was, I knew it was a good thing that I got the scholarship. It came from a teacher down in the basement of our house. But I felt, so at that point, not now, maybe upper middle class, but at that point we were definitely working class. And I felt out of place, like the kids weren't allowed to come down to my house. I don't know if it was, I think they thought it was bad neighborhood, it was very black, you know, I don't know what they thought, but I do remember feeling bad that they couldn't come. And then that made me not want to go to their house. So I felt like an outsider, but I think I exaggerated it in a way that I shouldn't have. That if I just relaxed into this school, it was my school, and I would have done better. But I mean, I did find academically that the education was amazing, and it changed my life. But you know, so it was a class thing. It was a huge class, and I dated an upper class. I mean, like a kid who came from like the upper class, and that way I was the first time I was like into one of their homes. It was a mansion in Georgetown. But you know, I was crazy about him. And I liked Robert. He would just show up. I'd never invited him, but he'd just show up. And we had to let him in. You know, it was like the family ethos. And he seemed pretty comfortable.
Yeah. Well, you say it changed your life. I'm curious how the experience of going there, I mean, was it a teacher or a set of teachers? Was it the community of students, or what was it that?
Well, it was really the caliber of the education. It was, I remember when I start complaining to my mom was out of sixth grade, where I had an amazing public school teacher, 7th and 8th at Gordon Junior High, everything was a repetition. So I wasn't learning, I wasn't moving forward, and there was a lot of racial tension. And I would get beat up by black girls. And one time they lit my hair on fire. It didn't burn too much, but it's just uncomfortable, you know. And
that was at what school?
Gordon Junior High. It became, it went out of business, and then it became, I think it's Hardy. It's right across from the Georgetown Safeway. But so, you know, whether that could have worked itself out or not when I got to high school, but I don't know if my mom was that worried, but this teacher downstairs was worried, and he taught at Sidwell, and he's just arranged it. So I guess because neither of my brothers are that well educated. I mean, they're not that well educated. They're doing fine. They make way more money than me, but just in terms of what I was exposed to in terms of ideas, and then I got to go to an Ivy League school, and that was all Sidwell. And the other thing that was important to me about Sidwell, it's a Quaker school. And I loved the Quaker meetings. I loved them. And I only spoke once at the Quaker meeting. You're supposed to, like, just sit there and think, and then, or you know. So, but it's an important, it was important to me. That we had those, and there was a feeling of justice in the school. I mean, you know, I could parse it. I thought that we didn't think about it enough, but I was still really excited that that was happening at my school. So I like that. So, yeah.
And in the period between when you arrived in 68 and the end of high school, which I guess was 70...
I think I went to high school at 74.
Oh, 74.
Yeah.
What kinds of, if any, changes had you witnessed in either your immediate neighborhood or more broadly?
Yeah.
If at all, I don't know.
Yeah, no, things were starting. I was aware of the pressure on renters because the people hung sheets out of a building on Calvert Street. And that they were on a rent strike for like 2 years. And then, so I was very aware of that. And this I don't remember. So my mom was always kind of an activist. If you go down my street, the firehouse is here, but if you go down, there used to be this enormous big old house, and it was on like four plots. And this developer had bought it, and my mom and some of her friends, maybe in this case Barbara did get involved, Barbara Nelson, they were fighting it, and they had an injunction to stop it for historic reasons, and he brought his bulldozer in the middle of the night, and she was just spitting mad, and we lost this house, and like maybe 10 townhomes facing 10 townhomes, which I don't even see that way anymore, but this house, I do remember running through, you could run through their yard and go to the back of Avion. So I remember the house, but I don't remember a lot about how it got knocked down. But my mother's like, if you say this developer's name, Jim Cohen, she starts spitting. Speculator. He was a speculator. That's so mean. So of course I decided he was a speculator. And so that happened. And I don't remember that as much as the new homes being built. And I remember, wow. You know, normally where there'd be like three homes, there were 20. But then it was pretty quiet for a while. It's happening now, like you can't believe. It's insane. But yeah, here, this is a thing I brought you. But they were, I don't know if you, I mean, if you want to keep them in Xerox, then you can. But so this was probably a flyer, and oh, this was about Seton Street. Do you know about Seton Street? Okay, so you know who's going to own that? As Morgan speculators, you know. And
do you know who?
This was from Ammo, I'm pretty sure. The Ammo Co-op Housing Trust must raise $100,000. Or 16th Street will be the new Berlin Wall. Adams Morgan will be white and upper class. You know, and this is what I was surrounded by, and I didn't. I wanted my neighborhood to be, you know, middle class. I mean, one of my friends was her dad was an exterminator. Another friend worked at a cafeteria. I mean, you know, they were just regular people. And then this just is an insight. This was when a bank moved into Adams Morgan, and they fought with the community, and they wanted to take up the whole lot, but the community made them build like that so we could have a farmer's market. Mm. And then I have so much more. I didn't want to overburden you.
No, I mean, I love it all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was that. Yeah, that's a flyer from them, and and you have these two. So, well, see, here we go. So, residents in the area of well, that's 19th and Corcoran. Okay, but anyways. And then, do you speak Spanish?
I don't.
Okay. Well, I think it's bilingual. Hmm. This was an illegal eviction, and this was somebody else my mother was always fighting, Carl Hirsch. He was a landowner.
Hmm.
Anyway. Huh. But if you tell me what you're interested in, I could also look for things, because I have, boxes of that stuff. Hmm. I guess I must have been really interested because I would take it from my mom
and this one's
and take it upstairs.
To you.
Oh, that's probably because I was a youth representative.
Huh. Do you have any clue what year this?
Let's see. I think it's pretty early because it's this says the Adams Morgan area has been qualified as an advisory neighborhood council. So if we could find that year,
that's got to be 74.
But you know, I can if you Xerox this, give me the Xerox. I'll take it back to my mom, and she might remember.
Okay.
Or she might be able to. We are putting together a housing program designed to help low and moderate income people, mainly Black and Latino, to afford housing. We'll need your cooperation. They were getting ready to do a survey. Yeah. Anyways.
Really, I mean, ahead of the times. I mean.
Yeah,
pretty,
they were. And they won some things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a kind of a fight that you have to always keep your eye scanning for enemies. You know.
I mean, I'm thinking back to what you were saying about, well, the different neighborhoods, and I'm wondering, was Columbia Heights a term that you ever heard used at that time in the 70s, or was that something?
No. And it was mostly Black then. I would have gone over there, but at that point there wasn't a lot over there that we'd had the things were burned down, but I remember we would go over to the old post office there, and it was funky. Like, it was a bad block. Like, my mom would leave me in the car, and I was like, oh my God. No, I wouldn't have gone over there.
Yeah. But Mount Pleasant.
Yeah, it was still close, and again, the Lujans would take me over there. And I met some guys from a band, and I had crushes on the drummer, I'll think of his name, but the band was Machu Picchu, and I was with Liz, I became kind of a follower, but he was just so cute, and he was playing the conga. I think it was the conga or the timbales. Plus, whenever there was a band, you would dance. You know, it wasn't like you would just go see it. I would often go with Liz, Liz Lujan.
Liz Lujan, friend.
I had the Eric Carrasco, right. Liz Lujan. Yeah.
And where would people be playing? Or where were their places at?
Yeah, well, I'm getting a little older now, but, first of all, they play at the Hispanic Festival, and that was in the neighborhood still, and it was just great, and they would march down from Mount Pleasant and march on Columbia Road, and then they'd go to Calorama Park, and we had all the kiosks in Calorama Park, so they would play there, if you where you danced, it would be in the dirt, but everybody danced, and that was really nice. And
were there any venues where people could perform?
Yeah.
Or was it more outdoors? Or?
No. There were venues. I probably wasn't quite old enough. Like later, there are venues I would go to. But when I'm like 15, 16, it's a more kind of community based. There was a club called the Gandhi. No, not the Gandhi Dancer. Biltmore Ballroom, and it was on Columbia Road, and they would play sometimes at that club. And then there was some place I went with a bunch of musicians, and I can't even remember where it was, and it was dark, but they were playing, and I went to that. And I had a friend named Hector Corporan, and Hector had a radio show on PFW. So sometimes right at the end of his show, I would go get him, and then we would go just somewhere, some club. It was intermittent, you know. So Hector was also, he had a brother named Gustavo, and they were both like movers and shakers, and both a little older than me, but I dated Gustavo, not Hector.
And so, I mean, at that time, at least from what I've read, is that the Latino community was growing, particularly in Mount Pleasant, and maybe in parts of Adams Morgan as well. What were the signs, maybe in your own life and in your own experience, of the growing Latino presence in D.C. in those neighborhoods?
Well, I remember the Zodiac Records store, and that was on 18th Street. I can tell you exactly, you know, I'd have to go look it up, but it used to have a bas relief on it of people, like one guy playing the drums and a woman, and she was bare-breasted, and she was like shaking the maraca or something, and that was there forever. And then somebody just recently like bricked it over. And but there was a guy named Daniel Bueno, and he was Dominican. He seemed to dress a lot in white, is what I remember. But he was always having like flyers for events, and if you wanted to know what was going on, you went in there. So that was something. Then there was on the second floor of one of the buildings closer to the Safeway, there was a Latino newspaper. And one summer I worked for it.
What was the newspaper called?
I think it was called, it wasn't this one, I think it was called, I have to check that fact. Can you make me a list of my checks fast? Check that one. Is I can I have a picture of me at that, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm like over, you know, we're like laying out, used to lay out by hand. And then this really nice guy. And then, so another thing was, there was a restaurant on the second floor next to the Imperial building that if you went up there, like all the Latinos were up there in the middle of the day talking, like, you know, doing stuff. And I mean, making things happen. And so that, the other thing that happened was Avion Frere, which used to be an Italian, very fancy place, the Lujans bought it. And they made it a cafe. And so all of the Latino community would go there to have their like one-on-one conversations and.
Do you happen to remember what it was called?
They kept the name, Avion Frere.
Oh, it was the same name. Okay.
But it was Pepe Lujan and Jeannie Lujan owned it for about 12 years. And then I think they sold it, and then they, you know, it stopped being a restaurant. But so those places, and really with that upper part of Columbia, it was really just being on the street. There were people selling things on the street. There was a lot of talk on the street. There were congueras. Sometimes my crush Louis, whatever. And seriously, they would just be up there. They'd just be up there like, dun, dun, dun. And then somebody would be like beating on a car. And it would just like go on for an hour. And it was great. Mm. So those were important places.
Do you remember the Wilson Center at all?
I do. I mean, I, like Liz, my friend Liz, I might have gone there once with her, but I didn't spend any significant time there. That her father was involved in that. So, but yeah, I didn't really go there.
And how did you decide to work for the this Latino newspaper?
Well, I was... now I'm jumping. I'm back. I'm all the way up and when I'm in college, but I was involved in my college radio station, and I was
that part, wasn't KCR, was it?
Yeah. And I was with, again, like, you know, it was very normal for me to be, you know, one white person in a group of seven Latinos or blacks, or you know, maybe there were two. So I was in this Latin news department. And then that summer, I thought, I should really keep cultivating this interest in journalism. So this is 1979. I do remember because Nicaragua gained their freedom. And we did a big layout, said that the bells ring for Nicaragua. That's what I did. I don't think he was paying me. So I don't know what I did to make money that summer, but I was working with him.
What do you think was the source of your interest? I mean, because did you end up majoring in Latin America?
Yes.
What do you think drove that? I mean, did you have any idea when you went off to Bar that you would be studying Latin America?
No, I thought I was going to become a lawyer and then fight for affordable housing. And then I went into my freshman year. My friend Gustavo was up there, and he took me to the college radio station at midnight so I could see like one of the DJs, and he was doing a salsa show, and it was called Cocinando, cooking, and I was just like, oh my god, you know, in the dark talking to people, it was really intriguing to me. But I think in terms of like of Latin America, I mean, I was interested in both Black and Latin American culture, and it's because I grew up around it, and it was a really vibrant, interesting thing to me. But yeah, I mean, every record I bought from the time I was about 14 was there's, you know, R&B or Latino. And I remember my little sister coming over once going, oh, and I put on some salsa. She said, don't you have any other music? And I was like, I didn't. So I think it's that, because there were people that I liked and then loved, like Liz and Erica. It was very interesting. The political aspect was interesting, or, you know, the older ladies fighting for justice at the AMMO, and you know, I wanted to be like them.
And what was it like then to start studying in a more formal way the history and cultures of communities that you grew up around? Did it change, or did it just deepen your interest and respect for what?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it definitely deepened. I loved knowing more and more. It answered questions that I might have had, you know. And also, you know, I stayed kind of in the news current, so it was really an exciting time to know about Latin America, you know, with the Nicaraguans, and then, you know, just as a journalist, those were big stories, and El Salvador and the Contras, so... I feel like I don't know if this fits, but I feel like in a very kind of, it's, I guess it's a stereotype, but in the most traditional way, that like upper middle class white people, they don't like express themselves in a really full way. And that when I was growing up and I saw all sorts of people do it, I started doing it, and then when I realized not everybody did that, I wanted to be back around the people who love language and they play with language and people who would never go to a birthday party and not dance. So, yeah.
And were there professors at Barnard that you particularly liked or had, you know, were influential in your own?
Yeah, there was a Chilean exile. So he had left Chile in 73 when Allende was killed. And his name was Marcelo Cadu. And I took, you know, his classes, and he became my advisor. He was tough, though. He did not brook any contrariness. And I remember questioning him once about something Fidel had said. I was like, you know, I don't know if this is really a good thing for him to just say, no matter what, if it's with the revolution, it's with it. And he attacked me in the class. It was humiliating, but I got a reputation among my friends. But he still was really, he made me really love Latin America even more. Like the literature and the, you know, he was great. But I did not stay friends with him. Somebody else I went to school with, to Barnard, she did stay friends with him. I was like, okay, well. But he was the main person, and then the rest of it was just a kind of like self-created apprenticeship at the radio station. Yeah, I mean, I would go there like every day. I got two radio shows. I was involved with the news department. It was like a job.
So what were your shows?
Okay, this is interesting. So I had a women's show called The Women's Room or something. And it was like, you know, just bringing on feminists and talking about different things. I remember I interviewed Linda Lovelace about, like, what was it like to be... She had turned away from pornography. And so that was... I think that was just a half an hour, an hour. And then I had Samba da Rua, which was a samba show. Because the salsa shows were already taken. And honestly, I could not really do a salsa show in New York. But Samba da Rua, and nobody had thought of it, and my show started at like 4 in the morning. So I had that little slot, and I would go up to the station, play stuff, and some musicians would call me. One guy called and blessed me in Santera.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then one guy called and said, could you please get some more records? I don't have any money to buy records.
And in KCR didn't have them in their collection.
No.
Not the ones that you were.
I mean, everything I bought, they kept. But they didn't have money for records. You had to get them sent to you, and that was hard. At least it was for me. But, yeah.
Wow. So was that your first foray into radio at KCR?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
And I wasn't that good, but I did it all the time. So I got better.
So you did these two shows on your own?
Yeah.
And how often?
Oh, every week. It was a thing. If I wanted to go home for the summer, I had to find someone to fill in.
Oh.
Yeah. Or I had to make deals with people in the jazz department. Like, maybe they could, like, have a couple more hours. And it was like it was a serious thing.
And do you have any clue what the range was of the...
It was broadcasting to Manhattan.
Was it back then? What was the frequency? Was it
89.9?
Yeah, 89.9.
Do you remember it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what it was later on.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if it had this always had the same.
Yeah, no. It's always, that station's been around a long time.